This episode of This Life, hashtag You Live, is courtesy of True Recovery, Hydrolyte, of course, hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew, and our new sponsor, Select CBD. Well, it's hard to believe a year has passed since one of the worst cold and flu seasons on record, but here we are again. So if you happen to catch a bug, the one thing every doctor will tell you is stay hydrated. Proper hydration eases a lot of the symptoms of many of these viral illnesses, and sports drinks, water alone, is not the issue. You need to be aggressive. You need something like Hydrolyte, full fluid replacement. Hydrolyte is this oral rehydration product you've heard me talking about. It's better than anything out there. It delivers the right balance of sodium, glucose, and water, providing up to 4 times the electrolytes sports drinks can offer, all with 75% less sugar. So think about that. It's like taking an IV by mouth. But my favorite thing is at the convenience. I'm always on the run, so I use the effervescent tablets. You just drop them in a water bottle or even a glass of water. I literally never leave home without them. No one in my family does, for that matter. And because Hydrolyte is appropriate for all ages, it's perfect for the little snowman amongst you when they come home from the school, perhaps sniffling. Hydrolyte comes in great flavors, orange, berry, and lemonade, available in a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or, like I said, those fizzy tablets. I love those. They go everywhere. Come in a little tube. Every package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Order your supply today at hydrolyte.com/DRDREW. For a limited time, you can save 30%. We use the code at checkout, DRDREW18. That's Dr. Drew 18. So either click through on our banner at drdrew.com or go to hydrolyte.com/drdrew and then use that code drdrew18. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get Granny out of the back bedroom and gather around the iPad. It's time for another podcast of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob.
Special guest Sam Quinones. He is the author of Dreamland.
The all-time greatest guest, might I say.
I think so, too, by the way.
I didn't know he was going to be on until I got in the hallway.
We tried to tell you. I don't think
No, I think it slipped through the cracks.
But as we,
you're one of my heroes.
Thank
you, gotta understand.
Very much. That's really kind of you. I appreciate it, man.
But before we get to it, Bob likes pretending this podcast is like the way they used to gather around
in
the old radio.
Old-time radio shows.
Terrific idea.
Except now it's a pad or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But and I've gushed on you before, Sam. You know.
Thank you, Drew.
And it was such a validation to read your book because I lived all that.
Right.
I got to tell you,
Hold on. So I need to tell people we have Sam on the opioid series. You can hear his commentary in chapter, Michelle, 11, I believe. In any event, he's very involved in that series as well. Also, there's a Dr. Drew podcast. I believe it's behind the podcast one paywall where you can hear my interview with him.
It's still open
at this time. You can find the... I think it's number, I don't know which number it is, but you can find it there.
337.
337, number 337, Sam's interview. But this is going to be different because Bob's going to be in here.
And okay, great.
Bob was a fan of
yours. I can't wait.
So here we go.
So I got to tell you, I got the book when it, about a year after it came out, a friend of mine told me, you got to read this book. I read it, I read about the first three chapters, I saw what you were explaining, it was what we were experiencing, and I just got so depressed. And that this is never going to end. Now it's been finally documented. Yeah. Nobody's going to care.
What do you mean?
Well, it's 10 years later.
Yeah,
Nobody cared when it first came out.
No, I know, but now shit's going down. Stuff.
So does it feel good to be? This book is going to wise people up. It didn't. The system still killed hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Well, I would say this. Yeah, people are dying in record numbers, and that is a there's a complicated story behind that too. But I would say that overall, I'm stunned at the reaction. I because when I was working on this, maybe like you guys, I encountered total silence. No one wanted to be out front. Media didn't really care too much about it. Politicians didn't really want to focus on it too much. And I couldn't believe it. I thought I saw all these people dying. And so what I've seen since the book has come out has been profound. I mean,
the last 3-4 years.
Oh, yeah. No, it's about people. I'm speaking everywhere.
I know.
I mean, I did 81 speeches this last year. 81 speeches and conferences and stuff. But what strikes me is the intensity with which people greet the book. And people come, they're nurses, they're doctors, they're families who've lost folks, there's mayors, there's on and on and on, all kinds of folks. And so I'm seeing that it definitely helped. It's definitely helped people understand. It's helped people get active and come out of the shadows in an important way. The problem is, of course, we spent 20 years getting into this, And so to think that all of a sudden within two or three that we would somehow have it all solved and back in the bottle is...
I think we're swinging back too far the other way. There are people that do have debilitating pain. It's a small percentage of the population. I get emails all the time that they're now cut off.
Yeah, and that, my wife has a... has an aunt who's suffering from very serious cancer, and she
cancer pain they're not doing.
Well, she has a fentanyl patch. It's not enough for the pain that she suffers.
I see they're afraid to give her enough.
And I think that they need to wise up that this is for some people this is absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
But it's like the pendulum swings back and forth, all or nothing, you know, and that's where we find ourselves today. I think what I was looking for, frankly, and even though I'm a layman in all this, is some nuance. You know, I'm looking for like, okay, let's spend some time and find out does this cancer patient need more? Well, then why don't we, you know, she's in her 70s, why not, you know?
Yeah, why
open
not?
Open up, or maybe...
And the thing that Drew always describes is the lawsuits directed at doctors that didn't prescribe enough was the key to it all, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because why?
Yes.
Because Drew and I differ on how many bad doctors there are. He thinks there are a few, I think there are a lot more than a few.
Uh-huh.
Right? But even good doctors we saw go to jail.
Yeah.
Amazing doctors.
Yes, right.
We're in this predicament, you know, of prescribe and kill or you'll be bankrupt.
Yeah. And I think this was part of how you got doctors to go along with this. There's the pressures on docs. When I first started this book, I would say that I had this one person explain to me what had happened. And she said, you know what happened was all these doctors got paid off by the pharma companies.
No, it's not
true. And I thought to myself,
it's not true.
Oh, that's interesting. And then I began to do interviews, and I realized it was not true. And so I began to say,
How could that even be possible? There's no way that could even happen.
Yeah. And so I began to see there's more nuance to this. So how did this happen? Well, there's a lot of ways. But one of them is, that doctors – began being the focus of investigations or poor evaluations, press Ganey scores that were low.
Right.
Losing
when they
jobs.
Were saying, all that.
Yep.
The thing I was most focused on, and it's still a riddle locked inside and nobody knows, like the Kennedy assassination. Who was behind the lawsuits on doctors? It takes a lot of money to sue doctors. It had to have been an
orchestrated
thing.
No.
By the pain, whatever that thing, that nonprofit.
I don't know how
pain.
Orchestrated it needed to be. You're getting a lot of patients who you get managed care. You're getting a lot of patients who are demanding to be fixed, demanding an end to pain.
Yep.
It might be a natural thing, but they hadn't sued before.
How come all of a sudden it became lawsuits?
Here's all it takes: a attorney who believes he can get it done.
Yeah.
And it was one guy. Who got it done
in Florida or
North Carolina?
North Carolina.
And when that guy got it done, every other attorney in the country went, "Game on! He can do it. We can do it too. It's perfect. It's a great way to make money without malpractice insurance in the way."
You know, I'm a conspiracy theorist. Didn't Purdue back the pain management nonprofit motive?
Yes, sure.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Right. Of course.
You guys are agreeing with my conspiracy.
But this is the nuance, Bob. This is the nuance. There also was the state medical societies getting behind pain as the fifth vital sign. There was JACO demanding fifth vital sign. And the happy face analysis. Remember all those we had to do?
Right.
The little happy, sad face. All of our patients were super sad faces because they were in withdrawal.
Right.
And the Department of Mental Health would come in and go, "What are you doing? You're making these poor people suffer." I'm like, they're in opiate withdrawal. They'll be good in 3 days. They won't even remember this.
Yeah,
and they were, without exception. One thing we never did in our entire career, 20 years working, we never at any point went, "What are we going to do with these heroin addicts? We can't get them off the heroin. It's impossible."
Right.
We had no problem getting people off heroin.
Right.
All you needed is a good team, cohesive, and knows what they're doing. This whole advent of the replacement therapies and everything, it's mysterious to us because we didn't need it.
Yeah.
In fact, I kept it out of the unit because I couldn't run the unit if there was an opening on the unit. All the patients would be preoccupied about it.
When Drew was doing it, he's an addiction doctor like you need, paying attention every hour, communicating with the team, so that we got people off 160 milligrams of methadone in like 14 days.
Yeah. 30 days, give or take.
But he was walking around.
Oh, Mike, yeah. He was good
after 14
days. Yeah, yeah.
Right? So there's a way to – and the the medical profession kept believing, oh, once they're on 150 milligrams or 200 milligrams of oxycodone,
impossible.
You can't get them off ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what's now I wanted to talk to you about. The Suboxone highway, the Subutex highway is the next thing.
Well, people, you know, like all these things, it seems to me it's all in how you use them. The same with the opioids.
Well, but also who's using them. You can remember people are using it that don't understand addiction and don't understand recovery.
This is also a problem.
Yeah.
I think that the there's this idea that medically assisted treatment, they're forgetting the assisted part of that. There are cases where I think where people just say, well, you know, to me medically assisted treatment seems to work best anyway with group therapy, with a variety of other things.
By the way, testing for other drug use other than opiates, which they refuse to do.
Yeah.
Astonishing now to me.
Well, here's a junkie, the KDAC counselor version of how you can tell a pseudo addict from a real addict. As soon as you put the real addict on Suboxone, they want to start talking about getting off of it.
Uh-huh.
When you put these prescription drug addicts, these pseudo addicts is what ASAM started calling them. They don't. They're fine. They take 4 milligrams. They're fine. They go to work. That thing and all those people are marketing Suboxone, it is in people who don't have a predetermination to addiction.
Well, hold on.
It will work fine
with. Too much. So, let me.
You understand what I'm saying? As soon as you get them stable on 8 milligrams, they want to start getting off.
Mm-hmm.
Junkies.
Yeah. Right.
Right,
because they're not right. They know they're.
They want to be higher. They want to be better.
They understand they're not well. We've expanded the spectrum of opiate addiction. When Bob and I were running a team, the opiate addicts we saw were all junkies. They were all like Bob.
Yeah.
They were real opiate addicts. By putting everyone in a little bit of pain, stringing them, even like every 17-year-old coming off knee surgery, stringing them out, you have a population that might not have otherwise ever developed addiction. So you've expanded. There has to be some genetic potential, right? You have to at least like it. I don't like them. I hate them. They feel horrible. So there's some genetic something in there, but it's a different condition than the real addicts that we were accustomed to treating.
Right.
Now, when they're in it, they will behave like a real addict.
Sure.
But they're different.
There's
how you
an
get
even
them
more
out.
Yeah. You know, one guy told me that his theory was sounded like an interesting idea, actually. He said he was an addiction specialist near Columbus, Ohio. And he said, my theory is that what we really did was we got, through this promotion of pain pills, we addicted all the people, a lot of people who might have been alcoholics.
Yeah, or mild alcoholics.
Yeah,
or
and
never
it
really
might have
alcoholic.
Taken 20
Absolutely.
Years before they had to come to me.
100%.
And now 100%. It's like they're falling off the cliff at 21
instead
of 45.
And that's a different disease. A different genetic subset, therefore different disease manifestations, therefore different treatment options. And so, but that's the real issue: is we don't have a nuanced
plus
approach.
Far less deadly. I mean, the thing about this
I don't know
one,
about that.
Well, I mean, because
they behave just like addicts when they're in it.
Well, true, but I mean, the folks who get involved in opiates, I mean, they die far quicker than alcoholics.
Oh yeah,
they're particularly with what also has changed because of this expanded market that you mentioned. Very right, correct, I think. You have seen the underworld all of a sudden in the last, I would say, 8 years, roughly, recognize this and provide. And the underworld, because it's unregulated, will always go to the most potent dope. You saw that with marijuana.
Cheapest, most potent.
Cheapest, whatever's cheapest and most potent.
Yeah.
It's also, of course, the most deadly in this case. It's not like marijuana in that sense. So now you have 72,000 people last year dying, most of them from fentanyl or heroin. Together, that's like 40.
But a large portion of this addict population that got created by Purdue, I believe.
Well, I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, there's what I found fascinating about this story was
if OxyContin if it wasn't approved by the FDA, this wouldn't have happened.
Dude, no problem with Opana and MS-Contin. I never noticed OxyContin as a prescriber. The ones that worried me was fentanyl, Opana, and
but they were really restricted.
Are
they
you
were
kidding
hard
me?
To get a hold
My,
of.
Oh no!
Are yes, you, they were compared to OxyContin.
No. No, because
I feel this way. That as I got into it, I understand your penchant for conspiracy theories. I come from the opposite point of view. As a journalist for 31 years, I tend to view everything as extraordinarily nuanced and complex, and maybe to my detriment sometimes. But I have to say, in this case, it feels to me like this is there are so many factors that went into creating this, and even I wrote a 400-page book about it. I even think they probably could have added a few more. Honestly,
yes,
you know what I mean. But my little brain can't conceive.
But where were the drugs consumed in disimpoverished parts of the United States?
No.
In West Virginia,
look, we are
Ohio?
sitting in Southern California, right up the freeway, 10-15 miles is some of the wealthiest suburbs in America: Simi Valley, Thousand Oaks, Santa Clarita, Orange County. That's the pill beltway in Southern California.
But the millions of pills you talk about being prescribed in hamlets of West Virginia by Purdue.
Sure.
That was because they're so hopeless and helpless there.
Every place has its own story, don't you think? What I tried to understand was, how could a Rust Belt Appalachian town have the same exact problem as Charlotte, North Carolina, which is a banking center, two sports teams, beautiful skyline? To me, that's the great question. Like, now, why is that? Is that an economic and despair story? Or is it, my feeling is, my hunch, there's a lot of that to it. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying that there's a whole lot more that has to do with basically American, I would call it just American isolation. That there's this, what is the common denominator in small Rust Belt towns in Appalachia, coal mining towns in West Virginia, and Orange County and Charlotte, North Carolina, very, very well to do.
Hopelessness.
Places. I would say isolation. To me, you look at their houses in Orange County, you go, what kind of hopelessness is this? Now,
Go in those houses and meet those
there
people.
Is what's maybe not there is something that sustains us more than material possessions,
right,
which is
exactly.
A kind of a soul nourishing that doesn't go on, perhaps, you might say. I just found it to be not so easy as to just say this company is the villain, and there we point. Because I find it, frankly, if you ask me, I really believe that a big part of this was Americans. We all, Americans,
for sure.
Wanted
for sure.
Something easy, an easy answer to a complicated problem, which is pain. How do we deal with
but
pain?
But there is a moral responsibility of the medical profession, the pharmaceutical industry, to protect the people from dangerous drugs.
Mm-hmm. That's the medical profession.
That's let me tell you something. All the lawsuits you mentioned in the opium series, the main lawsuits are after, and you correct me what the name of this company is, it's the distribution of prescription drugs in the United States. McMillan? Is that what it's called?
McKesson.
McKesson.
Right.
They're
yeah.
the ones going to pay. They're the ones made the most money. So I was a part of that for like 2 years, going after the money streams of who made the most money. That company did. So,
yes, and there's three companies that are the major distributors.
Right, and they were supposed to notify the federal government every time it went to a certain thing, and thousands of times they did not.
That's the allegation, and I think what's going to be interesting, what I can tell you as a investigative reporter, I am thrilled to watch this because they are doing things that I did not have the finances, the budget, time, brain power,
lawyers.
A huge amount of resources now being devoted to investigating how all this took place. And I was out there all alone feeling like, okay, I'm going to do this. So much of it was like, I was exhausted at the end. I was like brain dead almost at the end. I was just like so worn out. And now what I'm liking simply as an investigative reporter is to see all this investigative resources being focused on finding out all of this stuff. Like, to what degree did McKesson send X number of pills to some small town in Kentucky? I'm hoping we're going to find all that out. And then there needs to come, it would seem to me, the evidence will, I'm hoping, suggest very strong measures through which that doesn't happen again.
I guarantee you what they will find. I guarantee you. They will find an overenthusiastic pain management physician in these places that felt it was their crusade.
Mm-hmm.
They were crusaders doing the right thing. Don't you understand, Bob? These people are suffering in this little town, and I'm going to make them all better.
That's also, yeah. And here's
I
the thing
guarantee
about those
you
pills.
You will find that.
Here's the thing. Those pills were sold to doctors as a boon to their practice. First of all, primary care doc, you're burdened by all these patients. The ones that take up most of your time are the chronic pain patients.
Nothing ends the visit faster than opening your prescription pad.
And you get them out of your... And so it was sold as a... And this was key to what Arthur Sackler said. When you are marketing to doctors, make sure that what you market solves that one of their problems. And pills solved a problem. That's the problem being a pain patient who takes up way too much time. What ended up happening was, as instead of a boon, these pills became a curse to doctors, in my opinion, a lot of times. A good number of them got addicted to those same pills. Some of them got addicted to the money, which comes from having your waiting room full of people who are willing to pay $250 a month to get the prescription every month. That's another part of it. The other part of it is, though, I think increasingly they fed what Drew's talking about, this kind of messianic idea that not only should I, but I can. It's not possible to do that. And also, it fed, on the other hand, I think a certain laziness. Like, you're going to prescribe pills for whatever happens through the
100%.
door. 100%. You know, and so all of that.
And by the way, a lack of training.
That feeds on all of that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, training in med school for how to deal with pain.
Or addicts, or even psychiatry.
Or any of that.
And so primary care is doing the majority of psychiatry in this country.
Right.
I thought I knew psychiatry when I started working at a psychiatric hospital. I ended up working there for 30 years.
Yeah.
Can we deal with that, please? I ended up working there for 30 years, and within about 6 months of me being there, I thought, oh, my God, I don't know shit about psychiatry.
Yeah.
So I spent the next 20 years becoming really quite expert in it and never do anything alone. I always refer because I'm not a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But the internists think they are because they don't know enough to know that they don't understand what's going on. They have no idea what's going
on. The pills were overlaid on a culture of isolation in America, on a lack of training.
Well, okay, so let's stay with the isolation thing. Are you in the Johann Hari category? I think he's gone way too far myself. But
I actually don't. I hate to tell you, I haven't read his book. So I came to these ideas.
You're right, I think. But he goes way over here.
Yeah, I don't know. My feeling is that there's ample evidence in America that we have isolated ourselves horribly. We have destroyed the things, or not funded the things, or ignored the things that bring us together.
We raise our children wrong. Have you read that book?
Of the American Mind? No. But
Coddling.
Coddling the American Mind.
Yes, the Three Lies. Book.
Right.
Yeah. I heard the podcast on that. But hang on, there's more to it than that, though, because Bowling Alone, you read that book?
I haven't, but I know the idea.
He was the first to sort of point this out to us, I think.
Yeah.
But I think there's a deeper issue, which is in our family systems. We don't know how to stay a community. We don't know how to connect. We don't trust other people. We don't want to be close, because closeness was a source of pain and misery.
Yeah.
So that's what sort of...
What I find fascinating, frankly, just not being connected in a personal way to addiction, is how, when you begin to talk about this issue, you begin to dig into all kinds of issues of themes like that. I thought I was literally writing a book about drug traffickers, and that came in the form of guys from Mexico, or that came in the form of drug companies, whatever, marketing drugs, you know. And instead, what began to happen was I began to encounter these ideas or these themes, and I could not avoid them. On the contrary, I said, let the facts kind of take you like an ocean current somewhere else than where you thought you were going. And so to me, that's what I find fascinating about it. You can begin to talk about all kinds of, you begin to talk about great philosophical questions like, what is happiness? How do we actually achieve happiness?
You know,
the family is an enormously important element to the story.
And it's been disparaged in America for 30 years.
Yes, I think so. And also, it's been
Sam. Takes a village.
Forget the family. This book I just read over the holidays.
Yeah.
It's the most interesting thing, because I think parenting is broken the last 20 years.
Yeah.
I have two small kids. I watch what is accepted norms of parenting. I'm like, this is awful. And Drew knows, like, kids were crying at my son's elementary school when Trump was elected. I was like, how do six-year-olds know who the fuck the president is? It's their parents are fucked up.
Right.
Right? So this three truths that these two college professors noticed started happening in the 90s were interfacing with students who told these three things by their families, by their parents.
You were special.
Listen to this. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker.
So
avoid all life, fear and anxiety of life.
And let me put a stronger light on that. What do we do in obsessive compulsive disorders and phobias? We do exposure therapy. That's what we do to people that have those problems. We
not anymore.
Expose them.
We don't isolate
them. But no, as a country, you've decided now you isolate
them. Yeah, yeah. So what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Always trust your feelings.
Oh, yeah, oh, boy. Yeah. That's a problem.
That's Ouch. All children are taught that. I watch it every thing. It's crazy. And then life is a battle between good people and evil people.
Oh, yeah, see, God. This is exactly my perspective. That is how I view the opposite. That as a reporter, I can tell you in 31 years of doing I don't know how many stories, 3 books, etc., I have met exactly precisely one person who I thought to be an evil at heart, an evil person.
Right, they're very
Everybody
rare.
Else
they're
is kind
rare.
Of...
Right.
It's a kind of like very gradations of gray.
But greed is a form of evil.
But sure, but greed comes with other things that mitigate greed and,
right.
and
try to what support motivates, my family.
What motivates greed is emptiness, right? I see it all the time. I work in the recovery industry.
Right.
A lot of greedy people there.
I bet.
Yeah. So greed is another, I think, the false materialism, this society we live in. Yeah. It puts people in predicaments. Like you said, these doctors got themselves into a predicament.
But I think the pills were kind of the vehicle. They told you, and all this pressure to use them, and all these patients telling you, damn it, doc, you better fix me, and I don't want to feel
any
pain.
But how happy were the patients when they got the 180s? They were fucking happy. Well, but so now you got a room full of happy people.
But you
got
to understand, from the physician perspective, that looks who doesn't understand addiction, that's a good patient now. They make their appointments on time.
Right,
they pay
their
bill. They show up. They feel great. And
they're
tell me.
Good
and what's more, here's the other thing about the pills that I thought was interesting, and that is that doctors, like most human beings, get their validation, professional validation, from positive
healing.
Reinforcement. And
healing.
These are so when a patient leaves happy, doctor thinks, I did a good job. That's a good thing. That's
right.
A positive outcome.
That's
the
right.
Pills let people leave happy when actually in the long run it was going to be a damaging or dangerous.
Listen, they have a discipline in primary called the difficult patient.
Yeah.
And they put it all in one category. Inside the difficult patient, you have the drug addict, the borderline, the sociopath. They don't even understand those differentiations.
Yeah.
They just
go,
patient's difficult. How do you handle it? That's how primary care deals with it. We have to take a little break. Be right back. If you or someone you know is dealing with addiction, someone you love, finding treatment is difficult. It's very frustrating. It is a minefield out there. And the truth is, every patient's needs are different and evolving. People behind True Recovery in Orange County, California, realize that effective care is not one size fits all. That's why they have developed a comprehensive range of treatments that can address all facets of this disease. True Recovery's master level clinicians maintain small caseloads. They personally manage your case, allowing them to personalize the care. They offer individualized treatment plans from residential to outpatient, and always with an eye on a holistic approach and a focus on accountability. And as patients become ready, this is a key part of what True Recovery offers. They offer assistance with life and coping skills, school and vocational coordination, as well as community reintegration support and aftercare. I've spoken with the medical director at True Recovery, and I was impressed with the range of therapeutic modalities and psychiatric services. Their experienced team is well equipped to manage patients at all levels of care. To request information, a True Recovery can provide you the personalized care you need. Go to drdrew.com/true. Again, that is drdrew.com/TRUE. Well, CBDs are everywhere, right? Everyone's talking about them, and it's a topic that I get asked about all the time. Bottom line on CBD, although there are way more claims made about them, the clinical evidence right now, it's not all that clear, but many people are using it and reporting great results, and they are very encouraging. So I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD is cannabidiol, an extract from hemp. While you might associate with marijuana, CBD does not cause reinforcement. It is not the reinforcing component of hemp, but it is what's responsible for the calming or some of the relaxing effects that many people experience, not the high. Now about the products. There are a ton of them on the market today. Forgetting the vast array of the reported health benefits, it's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not the hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is described to you so you can make an informed decision without all those promises that are probably too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD by individuals using this are very compelling. I'm excited to see how things develop as the science catches up with this booming industry.
As usual, the public is ahead of the science. I can't make explicit claims yet, but boy, the reports are pretty encouraging. So if you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That's on my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. And for a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with the code DrDrew, DrDrew. Again, drdrew.com/select, and then the code DrDrew.
We are back. We're talking to Sam Quinones. The book is Dreamland.
Oh, thanks for coming.
I know.
Here.
It makes
sense. I could talk to you all
my
afternoon.
Pleasure.
You're
really nice to be here. Thank
it's
you guys
really
for having me.
How are we doing on
you.
Time, by the way? Oof.
So we're I'm going to tell you a funny story. So
yeah.
I was swimming in the same waters. I was very focused on the Sacklers and the Sackler family. Have you met Nan Golden, the activist artist?
She wrote to me once, and I wrote back, and I didn't hear back from her after that. I'm not sure.
Anyway, yeah. she's
Michelle.
An old...
Okay.
Yeah,
she's
a radical. She's a punk rocker like me, and she was sober in the 80s, and then got hooked on prescription drugs, and then
right.
has earmarked.
That.
So I was pitching this TV show called Dope Nation, probably about 5 years ago. We're in this meeting, and we got really heavy as to how we're going to plan and strategize me making their lives miserable and all this kind of stuff. And we were in this late night meeting, and I just said, "Listen, you guys. I'm a really good driver, and I would never kill myself." Because we were so scared of what we were going into. You were all alone. Weren't you scared sometimes when you were in that, writing that?
No.
You don't think they kill people that are getting
I don't
in their
think,
way
no,
of $50 billion? Dollars.
No. What I felt was not fear, but initially, briefly, very briefly, I felt like, oh, my God, what have I done? Signed myself up for a story no one cares about. And my family too, and then I got over that.
You didn't think that Purdue would care about it?
No. That other people in America, no one seemed to care about it. So why was
yeah,
I writing?
Why would
didn't
Purdue
you fear
care,
them,
Bob?
Fear them squishing you like a gnat, like with lawsuits and crushing you? Yeah. You didn't worry about
it? I wasn't.
You're a stronger man than
I wasn't. I wasn't.
He had the truth. He had the truth on his side.
It didn't seem to.
What do you think the tobacco industry investigative reporters had on their side in the 80s?
Yeah. To me, it did not feel like
it didn't feel similar?
That was going to happen. What can I say? It could have, but it didn't. So
It never crossed your mind.
It did cross my mind, but it didn't stay with me for a long time. I was too busy.
Yeah,
you know,
seriously,
I was just too busy, and the story threads were numerous, and I was trying to keep
them
all straight.
When did they start to find out about it?
Well, I don't know, but I wrote to them, and I wrote them a long email because I felt that I had one shot, and I said in this email, I'm doing this book, going to come out. Whenever it's going to come out, and when it comes out, I'm asking you now officially for interviews with the following people. So I listed both titles and some names that I knew.
But you probably talked to the guy who became the born again Christian who left Purdue, the marketer guy. You know about that guy?
No.
Oh,
no.
But okay, he had a change of conscience through becoming born again.
I wrote to their media department, right? And I had an email for one or two people, I don't remember. And I sent them this long email and I said, I want to talk about the following topics and then the following people. And Whoa. So it was a long email. I think I still have it somewhere. And they got back to me and they said no. And they said in two paragraph thing, they said, we're against the abuse of our drugs. We didn't produce it for those reasons, and we are working hard to see that no one abuses drugs, these drugs that we produce, and et cetera, et cetera. But we are going to have to decline your request for an interview. And so I took those two paragraphs verbatim and put them right into the book,
yeah.
in the manuscript, and that was all. And I never heard back from them after that. Maybe they didn't know who I was. I don't really know. All I know is I was doing my due diligence.
You get a marketing person, an attorney on it, and that's it. The attorney says, don't say anything. Here's what you write back, and that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. I'm sure that they that's had it. Some kind of...
It's medical liability. You understand, it's a medical liability is such a crazy environment. The people are busy protecting themselves all the time.
And, you know, I actually happen to feel that... I don't know. I don't know the law, and I don't know the precedent-setting cases and all this or what you would expect when you get to court. But I have to say that I felt that they did them themselves of disservice
mm-hmm.
That they particularly when there is they might have a story to tell And I thought that was a possibility.
But there's a liability attached to telling it, you see.
I know.
When the federal government comes in and says, we're going to get you, they can't admit any culpability.
I know. And what I thought they should have done is said, you know what?
I agree with you, though.
We really messed up.
Yeah.
For about 7 years, we messed up. And
doctors can do that and get away with it. Companies can't.
And then we are now going to devote $1 billion a year to treatment.
Right.
Whatever.
That's what the judge in Cleveland wanted.
The problem is that we've come to find is I found. pardon me. One second. Okay. Hold on a second.
Yeah, sure.
The problem with that approach is we've come to find, at least what I've read in later lawsuits, is that their first 7-8 years when they were doing this egregious marketing of their pill did not stop once they were sued criminally by the federal government. That they were supposed to stop. They were supposed to take note of doctors who were out of control. They were supposed to do all these different things. They paid a $634 million fine, et cetera,
et cetera. Is it true that the guy said, who do I write the fucking check to?
I don't know if that happened or not. but what I think is going to be shown now, at least I read a very interesting a lawsuit out of the state AG's office in Tennessee, where they talk about how Purdue behaved after signing that agreement and paying that fine and all that. It was not as much egregious stuff, but it's horrible. What they're alleging in that lawsuit, if it's true, is just an outrage because they were preying on doctors that were – at one point, I almost broke down when I read this. There was this poor doc in Tennessee who talked to this sales rep and says, you know, I really don't think I should be prescribing this. I don't think I'm actually capable and competent to do that. And the rep was, no, you know, keep going, doggone it. This is all, you know. read the lawsuit from the state attorney general's office.
I'm sure that happened. But why did the doctor keep going? And see, and the problem is,
they're lost.
Academic medicine. We follow our lead based on our consulting peers in the higher up institutions.
Yeah.
That's where we get our practices from.
Right.
And if they're signed on, we have to sign on.
Yeah.
Lest we want to address that in a lawsuit. Because the lawsuit will come at us. You always have to think when you're prescribing, what do you say on the stand when the other attorney or the judge says, Dr. Pinsky, were you not aware of Dr. Smith's opinion at University of Kentucky, where he has made it very clear that the prescribing has been underdone and you are adding to the suffering of patients? Yeah. What's your defense? Who's your academic backing for this? Well, it's been my experience, Judge. I don't care what your experience is. Academia says you should be prescribing more. Right. Why didn't you? You're dead.
And that's why
you're
the opinion of pain specialists
made everything
in the 90s was so important.
That's how
you learn. You go to these CME conferences and you're like, so-and-so's telling
you
this is the new
way. In the state of California, we were required to go to pain management symposiums every year.
And this is why I say, to me, it feels like there's all these different
threads
to this story that I found. I found that a more interesting story than the bogeyman story we can all point out to. Like, that's
the bad guy that would be easy. It wasn't that easy. But the very first pain management conference I went to was headed up by a guy who was a psychiatrist and an anesthesiologist and a pain management specialist. And he goes, I'm going to talk to you about methadone prescribing. He goes, funny thing about these chronic pain patients, 96% of them have a history of physical or sexual abuse in childhood. Anyway, let's talk about methadone. So I was like, I almost fell out of my chair.
Wow.
No talk about how to manage the abuse.
Yeah.
So you and I discussed a little earlier. Pain is a multifactorial process, and at its fundamental basis, it's a somatic experience, what's going on at the source of pain in your body, and a affective experience, the misery component, which is a part of your brain called the insular cortex. And the insular cortex has nothing to do necessarily with what's going on somatically.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be connected, but if you've had sexual physical abuse, they get disconnected.
Yeah.
And the body becomes a source of fear and misery at all times. And part of the multifactorial treatment, my uncle was the first president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine, and he ran a multidisciplinary pain program at Irvine, and I consulted down there a few times. And they had neurobiofeedback, they had MRI study, they had a thousand different ways of going at this.
That's a fascinating idea that to me, I did not...
He went out of
business.
When I was a layman, it was all new to me, and I was like, fascinating. The pain could actually not be due to a cut,
a somatic,
or a broken leg.
But there's pain, and then there's misery. Two different things.
Well, you know what? I then spent some time,
and then there's chronic withdrawal, and then there's amplified pain through opioid. It's called hyperalgesia. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I was going to say that I spent some time in speaking with the doctor who runs the VA pain clinic in Las Vegas. Mm. Very interesting guy, very articulate.
What's his name?
Alexander Usani.
Did you work with him at all?
No.
Great guy. You might want to talk to him at some point. Very, very thoughtful and young guy and very, very articulate. But he was saying he started that clinic. He was brought in from Salt Lake when they were beginning this, and he starts the new pain clinic for the VA in Las Vegas, which includes all manner of treatment. Right. It's not pills anyway. It's acupuncture and swimming, and the whole bit. And he starts telling me how part of the problem that they face in Las Vegas, as opposed to Salt Lake, where you have strong families going back 2, 3, 4 generations sometimes, you know, still alive. Transient. In Las Vegas, it's a transient town, yeah. You know, and people don't have a lot of money either, and they're here, they're there, they're going on.
This is back to the isolation.
And he says part of the problem that we're seeing is that the folks who are on the highest levels of pills, you know, they only come in to get – they were only coming in to get their pills. They weren't leaving their house for any other reason.
Of course.
Part of what it required as being – as the director of this is to – start thinking about how do we create community in their lives. And that is a treatment for chronic pain. That was a mind-blowing, beautiful, fascinating idea.
You know, there was this thing developed in the 40s and 50s that sort of acknowledged the same thing in Akron, Ohio, I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
Was it something called 12-step?
Yeah.
That's at its core what it is.
Yeah.
It's at its core. It's just we've been advocating for it for years.
Build community and build the understanding. The most powerful tool I have is – whatever an addict says to me, I can say, I understand, I know.
And
I
just I felt that. Brains change that, other brains, and then we've lost track of that.
And that's why.
But that gets into some of the stuff that you're talking about with those three things that, you know, that kids should always trust their feelings, that there's, you know, it's this approach to child raising that really, if you look at our neighborhoods, appears to be everybody indoors, quick.
Right. Yeah.
You know, don't go outdoors because you might skin your knee,
or you'll be taken away by a boogeyman,
or the car will hit you. All of which has happened.
I got hit by a car. I still rode around.
None of which is reason why the entire country ought to button their kids up indoors.
Well, right. But again, it's narcissism at its core, which is the child is an extension of me.
Yeah, they can't tolerate parents can't tolerate their children suffering.
Correct.
No.
So,
you know, my dad didn't even know we were suffering.
No, of course. Yeah. I frequently tell the story when I speak that when I was growing up, I grew up in Claremont.
That's where he lives.
Oh, you live there?
Sure.
Yeah. My dad's a retired professor of comparative literature.
Where?
Yeah,
which school?
CMC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he taught at CMC. He retired many years ago now.
How dare you call it CMC, by the way?
I went to
Pomona?
No, Claremont Claremont
McKenna
High School.
Oh,
yeah,
Claremont.
I graduated. And I worked as a dishwasher at Pomona, Pitzer, and a landscaper at CMC.
You ever work at the Danson restaurant in downtown Claremont?
I never did. I did work at
Marie Callender's family. That's my wife's family.
Is that
Danson.
So? Yeah, no. I applied to job there 3 or 4 times. They never took me. I did work for Marie Callender's. It's just closed.
Yes, on Foothill.
They just closed, sadly.
That's so crazy.
But the idea was that I grew up on the street where in the 60s, I'm 60 years old, so I was growing up like 66, 7, 8, 9, right in there. Every afternoon, we'd be my mom had to come to the street sidewalk every afternoon with a farm bell that she had from Iowa, where she's from, and ring the bell. That was calling her boys home because she knew there's no way we're going to be inside the house sunny Southern California afternoon. Now you go to that same street. Okay. I've been down that same street eight times.
It?
St. Bonaventure. It's right across from Oakmont School.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oakmont Elementary School, where I went to elementary school.
My God.
I've been down that street 6, 8 times, I'd say, in the last 10 years.
There's nobody on
Never.
It. Never anybody.
Not
on
one
it.
Person. Do you
know
see
what's
it
interesting? The students from the colleges never leave their dorms either. All
is that
of downtown Claremont is empty.
That's incredible.
It's the craziest thing. There's 5,500 students in that town, Drew. You never see them.
Well, they're busy.
studying. I mean, to be fair,
it's far more 60s, upsetting to me.
In
I
the
have 60s, to say,
you saw them.
Far more upsetting to me to see go down that street where I grew up, because that's some of the cheapest housing where we lived first is remains some of the cheapest housing. So you would think that there'd be a lot of kids on that street in Claremont. I mean, there's a very high priced town.
I say, is there such a thing as cheap housing in Claremont?
Well, now there is. Now, I mean, this street would be it if there was.
Right.
And you just don't see anybody.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
On Blaisdell that's Park, so right around the corner.
I don't think parents let their kids out on the street anymore. Even when we lived in Hollyburn, it was all kids. There were never kids out.
No, like, it was a bit. There was a bit.
Not much. Not us. Much. Just us.
Well, we now what it requires is that you actually make kind of an organized effort.
But here's the thing.
A lot less kids.
I live in a dirt road up off Live Oak, right? And there's a professor there whose kids run around barefoot, and my kids run around barefoot. So the idea is that we all know each other, and we see other kids, other parents' kids walking down the dirt road, and you just see out the window. It's about as close as you can come to the way that I grew up, right?
Yeah.
My problem is my 8-year-old now is becoming addicted to video games to get him out of the house.
That's part of the problem.
I found a way to do it, though. You just disconnect the Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
there you go.
It's crazy. You go, oh my God, the Wi-Fi's out. We better go outside.
My mom used to get me out.
It's
of
a
the
sad
house
thing. It's a sad thing.
A pack a day.
You need to now plan that. You need to now work.
Bye.
It doesn't happen organically anymore. And part of it, too, I'll have to say, is the families are so much smaller now. I mean, we had four boys in my family. It was a house that was very small, so there was. Staying indoors was not pleasant.
I bet
you know?
Your dad is probably friends with my landlord, Al Wachtel, the James Joyce. That's Al's my landlord.
Yeah, Rick Quinones. Ask him if he knows him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Al Wachtel, leading authority on James Joyce in America.
I think I went to school with their
Their kids. He has like five kids, too.
Yeah, right. Two of their kids.
A girl
I think
and a guy.
Yeah.
They're still around Claremont.
Anybody
it is weird to think Claremont is like this little part of Connecticut in Southern California.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's because of the high-powered school.
You know, the
there.
Motto of the town is most PhDs in any municipality in California.
That makes sense.
Well, that's probably true. I checked out Sycamore School at one point. We were thinking of maybe possibly going back there, and 46% of the parents of Sycamore Elementary School have PhDs. Is what they told me.
They all went to the colleges.
That's incredible. That's amazing.
That's crazy.
So,
good place to grow up.
Whose kid goes there? Pat Whitney's daughter goes there.
Pat Whitney.
The Bill Maher guy.
Yeah.
So who would have known that both guys going after the Sacklers from Claremont?
I'm not going after the Sacklers. I'm not. I'm trying to understand this very complicated story.
Because you don't want it to happen again? Because it already is happening again.
What do you mean?
It's happening again.
What do you mean it's happening again?
Benzos and Adderall. It's unbelievable. That's the new
cocktail. I'm going to tell you one thing. I have a whole lot of other interests besides addictive drugs. And so I think this topic, I'm going to work it as much as I can. And then I'm going to say, I'm going to go write about Mexican cartels or something like that. Because honestly, it's like.
Well, I can hook you up with some of those
guys. It's overwhelming.
But here's the deal about benzodiazepines. They're all generic. So you can't make the case that there's some evil empire behind
it. No, I'm not saying there's an evil empire.
It's all physician prescribing.
There's a hopeless population that is susceptible to wanting to check out for the same reasons he's saying.
Yeah.
Isolation. Yeah. Just don't know your neighbors. Don't you know, fear, and good and evil. Yeah. I'm good. Yeah. Whoever disagrees with me is evil. That's a society we have now.
I do buy the idea that kids are growing up with values that lead them to be less resilient, less able to deal with the turbulence of life, and that is actually a very very scary thing because they
that's who our clients are.
But it's the point that he and I talk about very often, which is the parents and the kids. We have somehow lost the notion of a normal life with ordinary misery.
Yes.
Ordinary misery is something that Americans will have nothing to do with,
and I think that's one of the roots of this opioid epidemic.
Yep.
The doctors began to feel that everybody coming to them, damn it, I don't want to feel pain, damn it, you
anything.
Fix me, damn
fix
it,
fix me for everything. Ordinary misery. When Freud set foot in this country, and they asked him, Dr. Freud, what do you come to this country to help us understand? He goes, well, I'm trying to really understand the difference between psychopathology and ordinary misery.
He did not know the difference, by the way. By the time he got here at the turn of the century, he was still trying to figure that out. And we have decided that ordinary mystery is always pathological, always something bad. And that's just not true. It's, in fact, good. We got to wrap it up. I see our producer standing over us. Bob, I'll let you thank Sam because I know it's a big deal for you.
He's a big deal for me.
I've already gushed out. Wonderful talking with you, man. Thank you very, very much. Say hello to Claremont for me.
Thank you for coming in all the way.
Oh, my pleasure, Jerry. Once again, thanks again for the
invitation. If you have any interest into this crisis that we have been through in this country, read Dreamland.
There's a documentary, too, right?
No, not yet. There might be a mini series.
Yeah, that's what I thought I heard.
There should be,
but not a documentary.
You can't tell on Netflix. There's so much on there. You don't know what's been made.
It might be HBO. HBO owns it now. So.
Oh, they bought it from you to do it?
Yeah.
The producer got it?
Yeah, I heard.
So we'll see if that
happens. That was a while ago,
A weekly infusion.
About a year ago.
Yeah.
Well, no, not quite. That's 8 months ago.
All right, we'll come back and promote it when it comes out.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, go to Weekly Infusion and look to the Opiate series. We have the whole sweep of the history. We put together, Michelle, here, our writer-producer, put together the entire history of opiates and humans.
That's fantastic. It just made me wish that I lived 1,000 years.
And in the series, we have the, obviously the written material, but I do a little audio book of it, and then we interview people that were very pertinent, like yourself.
That's great.
Pertinent to whatever topic is in that chapter. So look for that series being released soon at Weekly Infusion. Thank you all. Thank you, Bobby. Thank you, Sam. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
All right. See you guys.
All right. That's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC 790 Midday Live Talk Radio. Monday to Friday, you can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Zinc One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob, Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, and his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, Dairy W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com, drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at drdrew.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.